Welcome to Dairy Livestream. I'm your host, Corey Geiger, managing editor of Hordes Dairymen. We are broadcasting from the Cheese Cave, our studio in downtown Fort Atkinson at the historic W.D. Hord & Sons Company building commissioned by Wisconsin's 16th governor, W.D. Hord. Our conversation will focus on, will dairy have a social license to produce milk? I'm so pleased to have four outstanding thought leaders, and based on our dress rehearsal yesterday, we'll have a diverse set of viewpoints on this topic. As a reminder to everyone in our audience, this webcast will be available on our Hordes Dairymen YouTube channel 24 hours after the live event. Dairy Livestream is also available anywhere you'd like to listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Search for Dairy Livestream from the convenience of your smartphone and download it. As you hear from our panelists, please submit your questions into the GoToWebinar question panel. The earlier you ask a question, the more likely it will get asked on the air. Let's get rolling with the conversation. Will dairy have a social license to produce milk? Before hearing from Steve James, let's go to our first poll question. What was dairy's primary competition two decades ago? And we're talking about beverage milk here. Carbonated soft drinks, orange juice, bottled water, all of the above or none of the above? So go ahead and answer that question here. And again, we're looking back in time here is how this space on store shelves has changed. So we'll give everybody a little bit of time to answer that question. And you guys are voting fast and furious today. We're over 70%. So let's see what y'all think. Our first guest, and I think everyone on this panel will contend that probably all of the above is the correct answer here. Certainly carbonated soft drinks, which we call soda pop, orange juice, and to a lesser degree, years ago, bottled water. Now, bottled water is the leading beverage in the beverage case, where milk's lone competitors just over two decades ago. The buzz coming out of this beverage space these days can confuse dairy solid space on dinner plates and hence today's conversations on dairy's social license. Our first guest, Steve James, will delve into this matter at a much deeper level. Steve began his career in dairy by working 7 years at Ronniebrook Dairy in Akramdale, New York. That farm sold milk in glass bottles from its 90-cow herd. Steve then joined Dean Foods, where he, over the next 9 years, held general management oversight for roles including manufacturing, distribution, sales, marketing, finance, human resources, product packaging and development, and public relations for Dean's Swiss Dairy Division based in Riverside in Los Angeles, California. These days, Steve is executive director for the California Milk Processor Board, where he's responsible for the advertising, marketing, public relations, research, and promotions for both general market and the Hispanic campaigns for Got Milk and Toma Leche. Steve, the dairy story has evolved during your tenure. Talk about that evolution and how it's impacted dairy's social license.
Thank you, Corey. Thanks for the invitation. And I just want to say it's an honor to be here with all of you today to discuss something we all love, which is milk, dairy, and our ability or our desire or our responsibility to talk about it to our consumers. As the poll question indicated, back when the California Milk Processor Board was formed in 1993, we really only had a handful of competitors. They were the, you know, the Cokes and Pepsis and Tropicanas of the world. Consumption had already been declining, consumption of fluid milk. So California milk processors voted by referendum to assess themselves 3 cents a gallon for every gallon they sold in order to tell our story to consumers in California and to try to increase the consumption of fluid milk. Back then, when it was started, the Got Milk campaign made this, through our research, made this discovery that people only cared about milk when they didn't have it. So that was the birth of our deprivation campaign, the Got Milk with a question mark campaign, saying, are you sure you have milk? So, then it was, you know, it got immediately into the culture, into the zeitgeist. The phrase Got Milk was even all over television and sitcoms, and people have tried to leverage it for their own purposes, like gut junk, gut sand, gut porn, you name it. People have used that construct. But we still feel that we have a good story to tell. However, we can't just tell the story scientifically or by fact. That's something that we discovered again in our research and still to this day. People know, they consciously know the benefits of milk. They know it's good for them. They know about the calcium and the protein and all the goodness inherent in the product. But then they reach for the next shiny object, whether it's oat milk or soy milk or what have you. So we decided, and we still believe, that we need to engage with consumers at an emotional level. And our messaging needs to feed into that emotion that people feel about milk. Last year's campaign, Never Doubt What You Love, was an effort to remind people that, you know, it's always been there. They've always loved it. Never doubt, even though you have the doubters out there on social media. And this year's campaign, Get Real, Got Milk, is again focusing on people's desire to be real and to eat real. So we're reminding people that real is really in the DNA of milk. So it's one of these things where, you know, consciously they'll say they can repeat back all the benefits, but unconsciously they go ahead and reach for the next shiny object product. So we're dedicated to and committed to making sure that we engage with our consumers in a way that is compelling, that's relevant, that's entertaining, that's emotional. Because we have all of these other things at play, whether it's social media and social responsibility and environmentalism and all that, who take their facts, they form their beliefs first and then go get their facts that prop up their beliefs. So we have, as you said, it's an all-out effort across the industry, and we as milk processors in California feel that we have our job to do, and we enjoy working with and collaborating with other members of the industry and enjoy what they bring to the conversation in order to make consumers understand the social and nutritional value of milk.
Thank you, Steve. And you know, you used the word social media and social responsibility and talking about people's emotions, and really that all starts with a story, right? And be a great summation of some of that. So thank you, Steve. We're going to go to another poll question before we hear from Jordan Clark. So when discussing sustainability, what is the ESG movement? So this is an acronym that's been popping up more and more. Your options are environmental, social, and governance, energy, sales, and growth, environmental, science, and governance, and equity, stocks, and goodwill. Now, a lot of you are getting this one right. Probably could have came up with some other E, S, and G words here. We were working on that one last night. So we're over the 50% mark here. So let's see what the audience, and you guys got a good score on this one. The correct answer is environmental, social, and governance. That's what ESG stands for. And the ESG movement is definitely impacting publicly traded companies. And its impact, in my opinion, cuts a bit deeper in Europe than the US at the moment. However, none of us are immune to the ESG impact as it relates to dairy's ability to have a social license to produce milk and to sell dairy products. We welcome Jordan Clark to Dairy Livestream. Jordan has a strong dairy supply chain policy and markets background. After earning an economics degree at BYU Idaho, Brigham Young University, Idaho, Jordan joined Land O'Lakes, where he monitored global commodity markets, executed risk management strategies, and assisted with the cooperative's dairy plant optimization plan. Jordan also researched dairy pricing policy and completed a master's degree in applied economics at the University of Minnesota. Now working for Albertsons Companies, Jordan sources farm milk for his company's 9 dairy plants and sources store brand dairy products from co-packers nationwide. Jordan actively participates in multiple dairy industry associations, including the Dairy Institute of California, where he serves as board president. Jordan, having a social license to produce and sell milk, and all dairy products for that matter, is a complex issue. What does the situation look like from the vantage point of working for one of the nation's largest grocers?
Thanks, Corey. Well, Albertsons is in the business of delighting customers, and we hear that phrase a lot as employees, the reminder to put those customers first. And at the store level, the company strives to reflect those local consumer tastes and preferences with a complete offering of what they want to buy on the shelf in our stores. And so as a retailer, we're the ambassador for that entire value chain to the customer. How the products are produced, how the animals are treated, the environmental impact of the supply chain, all the way up to the point where we're putting it on the shelf and handing it off to that consumer. So whether we like it or not, the consumer may judge our social license to be their grocer on all the items that we sell based on what happens upstream of those items. Now, because dairy is so tasty, its value is compelling to consumers for that reason alone. So it's really encouraging to hear that per capita consumption is growing. And it might not be, it shouldn't be so much of a surprise, because dairy ingredients are so dynamic and they're so functional to make all sorts of meals taste amazing. And the dairy ingredient sector is discovering new ways to lift the nutritional and taste profile of foods all the time. So I think that's why consumption continues to grow. We definitely have a social license to produce and sell dairy. Of course, your question was more forward-looking. It was, will we going into the future? So today, people are understandably more conscientious about how the food they eat fits in with their values. Where's my food coming from? Does it feel good in my tongue and in my heart to eat it, right? And that's a very modern question. And because the supply chain is so complex, the customer can't be expected to understand how the whole supply chain works, every node on that supply chain from the farm, you know, through the processing facility, the commodities that change hand from broker to broker to CME, when it gets mixed in with other ingredients to become that meal that's packaged and put on the shelf. I think it's pretty far-fetched to expect the customer to understand all of that. Hence, you know, what Steve was talking about, keeping that message simple. But in the supply chain, it's not simple. It's anything but. And I think that likewise, as Mary is going to touch on, all the good things that the dairy industry is doing to reduce its environmental impact is also complex. And it's a bit tricky to reflect that story to the customer. And so, again, there is that challenge that Steve mentioned of, you know, sometimes some ideas or some opinions might be set, and it can be really hard to turn that narrative. As I pondered on this question, Corey, I kept going back to how delicious dairy is, in how much, how that creates such a compelling value for the customer. So given that we have a social license today and we want to preserve it, I think it's really important that the dairy industry continues to do the good things that we're doing to reduce our environmental impact, to ensure and validate that that our ingredients and our products are being sourced ethically, to keep pace with that conscientiousness that consumers are increasingly having, so that we can preserve that social license. And I'm feeling fairly optimistic about that.
Thank you, Jordan. A reminder to our audience here, as you hear our panelists, you can go ahead and submit your questions into the GoToWebinar question panel, and we'll get those answered in the second half of our webcast. Before hearing from Mary Kraft, let's go to a poll question. What percent of a cow's diet consists of byproduct feeds? And there's been some research done on this, so none. One-third, two-thirds, or the entire diet? So go ahead and answer that poll question. And this is really important, because there's some compelling dairy stories that consumers don't always see. But behind the scenes, it's stories and conversations that we need to lift up, because they're so important to the environment in our overall communities. So we'll give people about five more seconds to go ahead and answer that. We So Michaela, let's see what the audience had to say here. Michaela's our producer. So 83% of you did get the right answer. The correct answer is one third. Byproduct feeds are a great story and must be rolled into conversations about dairy social license to produce and sell milk. A study by the Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy recently documented that byproduct feeds make up about one third of the cow's diet, representing anywhere from 32 to 41 million metric tons nationally each year. Because those byproduct feeds have been fed to dairy cows, there was a 49-fold more positive environmental impact than if those byproduct feeds had been simply disposed, and part of that disposed could be in a landfill. This is just one example of research being done on dairy's behalf at the Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy that brings together the entire dairy community, including producers, processors, retailers, and others, to talk about and solve some of these issues related to dairy social license to produce milk. Our next guest, Mary Kraft, knows this story and so many more. Her family has been in the dairy business since 1906. Mary studied public relations at the Colorado State University and later earned Master of Business Administration and Management degree at the New York State Institute of Technology. These days, Mary and her husband, Chris, own and operate Badger Creek Farm and Quail Ridge Dairy in Colorado. Mary believes that as a dairy farmer, she has a huge responsibility to both the community and to consumers in helping them understand milk is a safe, wholesome product that comes from family farms. Mary, can you discuss in deeper detail dairy's social responsibility?
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I love talking about our dairy. I love talking about our industry. For anybody who's run into me before, you know that I tried really hard not to be on a dairy. This is the last place I wanted to come to because it's long hours. It's sometimes slogging stuff and sometimes doesn't smell very good. But what we have to offer in the dairy industry is beyond compare for many of the other industries. We have a recycling machine that is unrivaled in the world of making great nutritional milk. Here you have a live animal that's able to filter out all sorts of things and distill it into God's most perfect beverage, which is milk, and then we can turn it into lots of other things. So how we're doing that is with a number of byproducts, and that hasn't happened in the very far past, wasn't really happening. And as we've come up with manufacturing that helps us distill or part out or do different things to different products, we can do things. So most of us are wearing some sort of a cotton outfit. That cotton seed has been taken off out of the system, and the fibers pulled apart. The fibers are spun into the threads that become your outfit, and that little seed is left virtually to go into a landfill, and that's where it's been for the last 40 years, maybe even longer than that. But as we've come with nutrition, we figured out how we can incorporate that into a cow's diet. Cow, being a ruminant, has the opportunity to soak that little seed in the first stomach, cough it up, chew her cud, and then she's able to get into this little protein and energy nugget that other animals can't get into. That's a benefit in terms of cleaning up the environment. She's also responsible for high fructose corn syrup that goes into your soda pop. She's eating the other half, whatever is left over from making that, including things like beer production. So they've taken the spent grains, no alcohol left for us, because that's what they're selling. Those spent grains come back to the dairy, and we sort of work them like an egg you might use in your whatever you're making, your cake or whatever, to mix together all those fine ingredients. So we can pick up all the little vitamins and minerals and all the little fines of the corn products that we're feeding, and all glues it back together. So the cow has a nice, tasty, palatable bite. So that cow is getting a great experience, and what she's able to turn that into is a wonderful output for the environment and also for you as the consumer. More importantly, she's doing some other environmental things. Some people think of cow poo as a waste product. It is not a waste product. It happens to be a wonderful nutrient for growing corn, and all of that corn comes back into our dairies, and perhaps some of that poo goes on other fields that nourishes other crops that you're also eating or consuming. And so the cow is playing a role in this very big circle of life, and everything that she does is can be used multiple times. We think of ourselves in the dairy industry as primary manufacturers. So I spent a lot of time with economic development. And in economic development, you must have the primary ingredient that you're going to have for the rest of your manufacturing offering. So if you're going to make Starbucks Frappuccino, you really need to have some milk in order to do that. And we're able to combine all of these farmstead type ingredients into a single stream, i.e. milk, goes to the marketplace, and then it can be parted out into so many different ingredients, different uses, and become nourishment for your body. The economies of scale are another place where we've really worked on our social license. If everybody had to have one cow and go milk it every morning before you went to work, lots of people wouldn't be having dairy products for their breakfast, right? But because we figured out how to put a dairy together, and it makes better sense for you to milk 500 cows at the same time, because of the equipment that you have to purchase, the time, getting people who understand what they're doing, all of those things, the economies of scale start really playing in there. And it's the same as if you were driving a bus. When you look at a bus costs a lot to run. But if you had 50 people on the bus, 50 people's cars would use up far more fuel than one bus with 50 people in it. And to me, that's the same thing that's happening with what we're doing with some of these larger dairies and the operations. We have invested because we're larger. We've had some economies of scale opportunities that have allowed us to purchase things like transponders. And many dairies, you know, you can't afford this if you have two cows. You just are not going to make that initial investment. But as you get going, you can afford to have that. And what that does is my cow actually can speak to me. Dr. Doolittle was the only guy who had the opportunity to talk to the animals before. Now I have an opportunity for every morning my cow can raise his hand, her hand, and say, I'm not feeling good. Somebody should come find me and see what's going on. So we've come up with ways that we're feeding the world. We're making sure that the cows are in wonderful shape. They have the best of environment for them to live in. And then they have a voice and they can talk to us and say, you know, even though it's a large dairy, they can say, hey, I'm not feeling well. And she gets individual attention and care. So I think all of those are propelling stories that we need to be sharing about dairy's stewardship of our cows, our planet, our people.
Thank you, Mary. I really like that Dr. Doolittle analogy there. Obviously, a movie from a few years back where the lead character could hear animals and really understand what was going on. And you're right, through technology, we are almost living that out each and every day. We're getting some questions rolling in here. I want to remind our audience that if you'd like to ask a question, use the GoToWebinar control panel and ask your question there, and we'll get it in our production studio and ask our guests in the second half of this dairy live stream. So our next and final poll question is, how much has dairy reduced its carbon footprint from 2007 to 2017? The options are 1%, 19%, 49%, and 99%. So there's been some research done in this category. And quite frankly, we do need to do research and document some of this data so that we have a foundation to tell dairy's story and our license to operate and sell dairy products. So go ahead and answer this question. I know we have a lot of documentation back to the 1940s, but this is a more recent snapshot in time here. So we're over the halfway mark. So let's see what the audience had to say here. 58% of you got this one correct. The correct answer is 19% reduction in the carbon footprint. And that's according to 2019 research by Jude Copper and Roger Cady that was published in the Journal of Animal Science. We welcome back to Dairy Livestream Cornell's Chris Wolf. Chris, will dairy have a social license to produce milk? Is an important topic as it ultimately impacts everyone in the dairy community. You've been studying this idea and concept in the whole space. What's your take?
Thanks, Corey. Happy to be here. So as we've kind of seen from the first three speakers today. Consumers are increasingly interested in the methods that are employed in food production. Recent trends have required farmers and processors and co-ops to respond to demand issues related to consumer preferences and perceptions. And as a result, you know, agriculture as a whole, but dairy specifically, is facing increased pressure to justify or adopt sometimes changes to their production processes. And the pressure here often relates to the production process themselves and or the resulting effects, if we're talking about, for example, environment, rather than the output characteristics of the products. And these changes then can end up happening for market access and through market forces, or sometimes through laws and regulations. More broadly today, we're talking about social license, and let's just take a step back here and define it. Social license is the acceptance of a business or industry's practices by the public and relevant stakeholders. And it's important for many reasons, but the most kind of fundamental aspect is that without social license, industries end up regulated, monitored. They end up with extra laws and other regulations that they have to deal with, which increases cost and makes things less efficient. So the other side is that farmers are and have traditionally been very trusted and admired. In 2021, there was a Gallup poll that found that the most trusted industry in the country was agriculture, with 69% of Americans having a positive view, 19% neutral, and 11% negative. The second most trusted industry was the grocery industry, with 63% having a positive view. And the third most trusted industry was restaurants. So the entire US food industry is very trusted by and admired by consumers and citizens. So that's a good thing. At the same time, less than 2% of the US population being farmers means that many Americans are really disconnected from commercial agriculture. Most Americans not only don't farm themselves, many don't even have relatives anymore or close friends that have farm and have never visited a commercial operation. So they simply have no context to understand the production methods and their potential impacts. Also, you know, given what seems like frequent bad press about agriculture, I think farmers can sometimes get frustrated by consumers' lack of knowledge about the practices and technology that they utilize. But the Gallup polls results suggest that food and farming are viewed very positively. So while there are certainly topics where consumer education and engagement will be very useful, you know, it's not particularly productive to have a defensive stance. And it's good to see that, you know, the dairy industry is being very proactive here. And the trust that's built up already suggests that, you know, there's a lot of social capital for the dairy industry that could be leveraged and to take a leadership role. So the industry needs to continue to look for improvement, tell their story in a positive tone, which is what, for example, Steve was talking about. Also, I think it's important to realize that a lot of people learn through the kind of storytelling, and that's really, really what we're talking about with all these different aspects today. And so leading the discussion here, I think, is important, because on all different aspects of ESG, the direction that we're moving in, the measures that are going to be important, and what potential policies and market impacts are going to be, the dairy industry needs to lead on.
Thank you, Chris. We're going to go straight into audience questions here. And I think, Chris, we're going to start this one with you, and then we'll open it up to Steve, Jordan, and Mary, because you go through data a lot. So I'm going to read this one. In reading about a survey where 94% of consumers said sustainably grown and sourced food was at least somewhat important, the same survey, however, found that only 1% could correctly differentiate between true and false statements about sustainable farming. How do you account for this disconnect, and how does it affect the question under consideration? Obviously, the question is, our dairy live stream, will dairy have a social license to produce milk? So,
wow, so that's an interesting, without, you know, having seen the study. Well, first of all, sustainable is a pretty big word, right? It means a lot of different things, right? So when I think about sustainability, for me, the dairy industry has to be sustainable in at least three different dimensions. One is financially, because even though it's fun to do, right? Mary will tell you, and it's good to be part of the industry, it's still a lot of work. You still have a lot of time in capital invested, and you've got to get some returns. So it's got to be financially sustainable. Secondly, it's got to be environmentally sustainable. And what that means is really evolving over time, right? This fundamentally looks very different than it did 20 years ago with what we're looking at and what we're understanding about environmental impacts. And then third, it's got to be socially sustainable. And that's kind of involves a whole bunch of different aspects, from farm animal welfare to the way employees are treated, to the way businesses are organized, to all that stuff. So in my view, a lot of times people will pull out the definition that they want to use. And so, you know, part of it is you've assigned your own definition to what it means to be sustainable. And then, as Steve pointed out, and he probably has more to say about this than I do, some people go looking for their own facts to support something that they've already concluded. But really also makes it very important how we tell the story and what's told.
Steve, definitely comes back to the statement you made early, forming your beliefs and then going to find facts, but go ahead.
Yeah, and the results of that that study, that survey, really, really highlights what our challenge is as storytellers, as communicators. People have their opinions, and they're very, very important opinions, but they're very lazy on the research side and on the delving into what it is that makes that opinion and the components of it that are important to them. That's why we need to tell our story in a compelling way, because people listen to stories. They sometimes facts just go in one ear and out the other, but they listen to stories. And that's why I'm really gratified that the dairy industry has gotten so much better at telling the good story about what's going on throughout the value chain, all the way from the farm to the store shelf.
Jordan or Mary, what would you like to add? This is really the whole reason we're having this dairy live stream, this first question.
I'll go ahead and comment on it. I was thinking about how sometimes, you know, human beings can be complex and contradictory. We're one thing that's fair to say, I think, is that human beings are creatures of habit, and we start to adopt, you know, ideologies, while our behaviors tend to be a little bit slower sometimes to change, even as our ideologies might start to shift a little bit. I'm thinking that if you'd asked me 5 years ago and every year since, if I should start running every morning and get up a little bit earlier and make sure I got extra sleep, I would tell you, yes, that is significantly important to me. I haven't been running. I should, right? Because it's my ideal. So I think it's really important as an industry for us to listen to the customer, listen to their values, right? And we're all, you know, as I mentioned, you know, last time I was on a panel with you, Corey, you know, we're all customers, right? So we can really empathize, because I think a lot of these values we hold as well. So pay attention to them and cater to that customer. At the same time, I'm not terribly worried that if the ideal is ahead of our own capacity to catch up with it. I think that's very natural. We're, as an industry, finding how we can increase our productivity with limited, you know, while limiting the amount of inputs and environmental impact to do that. And the consumer reasonably be impatient to have more stories that demonstrate that they can feel good in their hearts as they eat the food that's delicious, right? But I don't think we see, you know, wholesale turning away of consumers, because there's varying degrees of ideals that perhaps aren't being met. But if we're on the journey with them, I think we'll be able to preserve our license.
Yeah. And I would add on there, you know, we as producers, we've all kind of, the reason we're in business is that we're in business for ourselves. We can do it the way we want to. And frankly, there are so many different cards you get dealt for whatever part of the country you live in, the people pressure around you, the terrain that you live in, all those sorts of things sort of determine how you're going to come at your dairy proposition and make it work. And so we all have kind of different ways that we come about that. And I think part of the communication system is the farm program. And I can tell you, I was a little grumpy that somebody was going to come and tell me that that's how I needed to behave and I needed to do X, Y, and Z when I was handling a calf or milking a cow or whatever. But I do believe that that's going to be one of the report cards, and is one of the report cards that we're being judged upon on how we're doing things. And frankly, when I look at all of the components that are in the farm program, it's all about doing a better job of animal husbandry. It's about doing a better job of people husbandry. It's doing a better job of environmental husbandry. And that thought process coming to the forefront of our minds, I think is imperative for us as farmers to be thinking about that. Not that we weren't before, but it puts it more into a formalized process, because frankly, as we get to the economies of scale I talked about before, you're not the guy who's doing the thing out in the field. You have to be able to share that protocol, that concept, that end in mind goal with your employee. And if they don't understand what they're trying to get to, and that, you know, that animal humane handling is very important to you, that's something gets missed. And I think it helps us do a fantastic job at the job that we're doing. And, you know, certainly gives all of our manufacturer, all of our sales partners, the opportunity to say, but did you look what these guys are doing in terms of stewardship? They're taking care of the environment. They're taking care of cattle. They're taking care of the people.
Thank you, Mary. And that audience member who originally raised that question sent another note in that his source for that question was the State of the American Farmer Report, which was created by Land O'Lakes, and it was released apparently today and summarized in an AgriPulse newsletter. So audience members can go about looking for that. Mary, the next question comes in directly from you, and it comes from a dairy producer. It says, Mary, I'm so appreciative of your perspective. I work in a region that has farms that may be classified as quote unquote small farms. I'm trying to learn the economic impacts that these farms have in this area that range from 30 head to 500. I hear from folks that are not farm orientated that farms can be industrial. I think it's important to have these discussions with research and numbers. Would you comment?
Absolutely. Somebody used the F word on us. They called us a factory farm. About fell out of my chair, because what we think of as a factory farm is what happened in the 1950s and 60s. It would have a pipe leading to the lagoon, pouring filth and smokestacks and things like that. That's a factory. I'm hopeful that we can sort of have a different conversation about what a factory is, because when you look at what happens in most manufacturing opportunities, there is a huge eye towards protocol, towards making sure that the quality standards are there and met every single time. So there's inspection, there's safety standards for the employees. So there's a number of things that are going on as that factory is rolling forward and putting things together. When I think about buying a vehicle, I want one that came from a factory where they have standards about how close my brake pads need to be, and that they actually work, and that the steering doesn't have a bunch of play in it. Those sorts of things are very important to me. And I feel like the consumer, we need to sort of take some of those words back and say, look, we are a manufacturer. We are putting things together in a grouped or bundled fashion, and we're trying to handle them in the most efficient one, because you want us to do this for not very much money. So we're going to have to figure out how we do that. And as all of us have started out on smaller dairies and worked to bigger ones, we started out with 120 cows. I started out milking calves, feeding calves when I was 7. I had my own milking shift by the time I was 11, and I worked from 1 in the morning until 6 in the morning, then went off to school. And it became abundantly clear to me in a short amount of time, I didn't have to be very old to go, look, if I have to be the guy who milks the cows, feeds the calves, does all those things, I can't do a really fantastic job at all those, but I can do a really good job of teaching people how to do the same job that I would do if only I could be there. And so I think that's the opportunity for growing your dairy from a 30 cow head to a 50 cow or 500 cow facility, is keeping in mind that you do have tools and supplies to change the thought processes you have, but also embellish and uplift the processes that your people that you're gonna have to have in order to get to those sizes include, and recognize that you are going to make a larger and larger impact in your local community by having a larger and more productive farm. So you're valuable as a larger one as well as a small one.
Chris, anything to add in that, to that?
No, I think Mary did a nice job. I think one thing about dairy farms in general is that they have a big economic impact locally, which is why states, try to encourage the growth of the dairy industry, because they hire a lot of employees, they buy a lot of inputs, they support, input equipment dealers and feed dealers, and they have both, and they support on the other side the processors and stuff. So dairy of all different sizes, it helps for the impact locally.
You know, when we put this program together, I didn't think about this next question coming in, but it's absolutely in the bullseye. We talk about social license to produce milk. There's states that have ballot initiatives. Mary, you used a word earlier, a few minutes ago, people pressure around you. And you operate in a state with ballot initiatives. Steve, you operate in a state with ballot initiatives. Idaho doesn't have one, Jordan, but you certainly are president of the Dairy Institute of California. So the following question comes in, and sometimes it's easier to talk about other industries than your own. So this viewer writes, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday regarding California Prop 12 on regulating the amount of floor space a sow must have. What are the panel's thoughts on the right of a state to establish requirements for products sold in your state? And really, it's part of the social license. Instead of here coming from the consumer, it's the citizens of a state.
Well, in Colorado, we're about to get some new thing, depending on what happens in the election this fall. We have, to avoid politics, we have some interesting people who are in power positions who have the opportunity to put some things forward. So we will have probably either a ballot initiative or something that comes through the legislature about, we've already had some pressure about Meatless Mondays. We've had issues about animal confinement. There was an initiative that was run in Colorado and had some very ugly connotations about artificial inseminations and forced sex. And so these things are coming. I think it is imperative that we spend time with our legislators. We do gobs of tours. If you have the opportunity to get people out on your place, I understand we would like to tweet about it. My generation doesn't do that. So all of you younger people who do that, lovely, do it. But I think there's an opportunity to get people out there, and especially legislatures, so that they understand the things that you do, the harnesses that you have. I had an opportunity to speak to a group of women the other day, and we were talking about artificial insemination and how vital that was for many women's fertility and for being able to do embryo transfers and some other things like that. So I think there's an opportunity to have conversations about what dairy does bring to the world in terms of some of the scientific propositions, but in no case should you take them lying down. Don't think they're going away, because they don't go away. They have funding, they have an agenda, and it is important to band together. So I've been president of Colorado Livestock Association, which is a multi-species group. And the reason we got together is we had some animal activists come to town, and they were after the swine industry. And we were like, yeah, take those guys. Right? And they did. And so we have almost no hog operations that happen in Colorado, or the ones that are here are highly regulated. And when we saw that, we finally realized that we were going to have, if they made it in with one toe in, they were going to come in with two, then three, and pretty soon it was going to be insidious and they'd be everywhere. So we got together with other livestock organizations so that we weren't going, well, you're not talking about us. So, you know, when you're coming, you talk about cage-free eggs, we're not going to worry about that. We're going to worry about that. We're going to be talking about all of those animal husbandry things that people who don't have anything to do with animal husbandry want to regulate. And show up. The world is run by those who show up. It's got to be you.
Steve or Jordan, would you like to add to that? You have different perspectives in your different states, of course.
Well, Mary, I think you said it really well. We have to, as an industry, reclaim the narrative. We have to be in charge of the narrative, and whether it's, as you pointed out, redefining factory and what that means and what's necessary about running a large operation that is already one of the most heavily regulated foods anywhere, because our children drink it, our you know, it's so widespread that, you know, it's, as an industry, I think there's a lot about regulation that we embrace because it lends itself to the food safety argument that we can make, that I think is held up to a very, very high standard for a good reason. But reclaiming the narrative and redefining the terms and educating the voters in the case of a ballot proposition and educating our consumers at the shelf, at the point of purchase, I think is all our mutual responsibility.
I'll add to that. There was a ballot proposition not too long ago in California to, it was really targeted toward clamshell packaging made out of polypropylene. The unintended consequence, if passed, would have also impacted yogurt packaging. And but it wasn't even at all the intent of the proposition. That would have required yogurt processors to change their packaging, which then would have implications on the FDA approving such packaging, which would have inevitably led to no yogurt in California for a while, right? It would take research and development, and then, you know, the slow gears of government to approve it. It didn't ultimately pass because of the cooperation among trade organizations. And so what Mary is talking about, the importance of keeping an eye out across you know, industries, across animal husbandry, for example. In this case, it was packaging that would have impacted the demand for dairy. It's a lot to be observing, and I think our trade organizations are really, really important. It's important to support them and to be engaged in them for that reason, and to cross-collaborate with them. As far as the proposition for pork that, or the way that swine is or pork products are produced, that's hitting the Supreme Court. I mean, it's a question of states' rights. Some states, you know, they regulate what's, I don't know if this is analogous, but, you know, a tanker in the Pacific Northwest can have a net weight of 72,000 pounds of fluid milk on it. But, you know, if you go south into, you know, the surrounding states beyond Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, then it has to be 50,000 pounds. So I was just thinking of an analogous, like there's some precedent, I don't know if it's a perfect fit, where one state, you know, regulating commerce in one way or another, you know, takes place, but it's a weird gray area. I'll be really interested to see what the Supreme Court decides to do. If they can make the scope of it narrow, I would hope they could, because the unintended consequences of considering this issue could be large and broad.
Thank you, Jordan. You know, and Mary was talking about this earlier on, you know, when we talk about discussion of dairy live stream, our social license here, having farm tours and interacting with your community, it's really about building social capital, because if you have those relationships and something happens, now you have a group of people that have interacted with you and say, no, I know somebody that actually farms, a dairies or runs a hog farm. And so that's where those communication portals are so important. Steve, I think this next question I'm going to send your way, because you've spent a career studying people. We hear a lot about millennials these days, and millennials have characteristically been drawn to authenticity versus authority. And they tend to believe more people like us versus opposed to be looking at experts. How has that changed this whole situation on social license?
Well, it's a great question, and it involves the word authenticity, which I think milk and dairy really owns. If you talk about other foods, and I'll narrow this down to other imitation milk-like beverages, we've done focus groups where people walk into a room where they have, we've set out all the packaging out on a table and they're looking at them. We say, look at the ingredients. And they see milk is milk, vitamin A, vitamin D. Period. And then they look at the 17 ingredients in almond milk or soy milk or oat milk, and their eyes bug out and they realize that this is a very heavily processed, heavily modified way of imitating a product that has been around for 8,000 years. So I think authenticity is something that we certainly intend to claim ownership of and to remind people of the importance of that, because they're seeking authenticity in every other aspect of their life these days as millennials and Gen Z. Another really fascinating thing we found in our research was, and we are, because we're a commodity board, we are not permitted to disparage other products. We can only talk about the good things about milk. So this non-disparagement, I think, is important as a concept, but also it works in terms of our messaging, because we're not vilifying the people who have oat milk in their fridge or soy milk in their fridge, because in large part these days, people are what we call dualists. They have real milk and they have soy milk and they have oat milk and they have all these things in their fridge because of different either dietary or taste issues. And the interesting thing we found in the research was that the people who had both kinds, an imitation milk and real milk, over-indexed on their consumption of real milk compared to the ones who only had real milk in their fridges. So I think it's a really interesting phenomenon. We're still every day trying to figure it out. When you say we've studied people for a long time, we still are, because we're, as Jordan points out, we are a very interesting set of individuals to try to come up with a solution for and a story for.
Chris, this is gonna be a little bit different perspective. And I thank Steve for that. You've been teaching students here for nearly three decades. How have students changed over time? And you know, really, you're not marketing to students, but you're teaching them, and how they receive information and how they share information maybe has evolved. What have you seen?
Well, you know, I think increasingly we are marketing to them. At least, you know, that's the way, that's certainly some of the changes, and many of which are good, that have been made in recent years to more serve student needs. It's a little bit different than when I was in school. No, I mean, look, there's a lot of research on the different generations and the way they process things. And it's definitely the case that they receive information differently than previous generations, and that they have a different set of priorities. And it's important to the dairy industry challenges to kind of reach all the different generations, right? But in particular, the younger generation, because that's when they form the habits. And you don't want to, you know, there's a lot of research that suggests, you know, that by the time you're in your late 20s or 30, you've formed a lot of the habits that you're going to have from that point on. So, you know, reaching the younger generations is key in all these ways.
Mary or Jordan, anything to add on that question of communicating in authenticity?
I think you just have to keep doing it. The more you communicate, the more your message gets across. And sometimes it goes out into what you think is a big black void. You don't know who picked it up. You just got to keep transmitting more.
Yeah, and I would just state that it's a good question to point out the problem with greenwashing. Because, you know, which means to overstate some, you know, sustainability goodness with claims that are wishy-washy or untrue or exaggerate the truth, because consumers will see right through it, or it will reduce meaning where those efforts are genuine and authentic, because you'll lose trust with the customer.
This next question that rolled in, I was trying to figure out who to send it to first, and I think my answer is Jordan. Bear with me for a second. A couple of decades ago, in the wake of the BSE scare, so that was up in Canada, we came close to a national ID program establishing traceability throughout animal agriculture. In the end, the effort failed. Are we missing an important element in providing consumer confidence in our products? So we, you know, traceability was having identification in every animal. And if something went haywire, you could figure out the source and restore supply chains. Now, we don't have traceability in animal agriculture, but you do a lot of product traceability. So maybe talk about that as it relates to social license, as it relates to consumer confidence.
So I know that we have the ability to trace our finished goods down to our processor and through the pasteurized milk ordinance and other regulated entities in the milk supply chain, we can trace, you know, milk to its origin. How that works is a lot of documentation, and I'm not an expert in it, but I've seen it at play, where if there is a customer complaint about a jug of milk that was distributed to a store in an area where we have several co-packers supplying for, you know, the entire grouping of stores in that geography, that it can be traced all the way, if need be, to the farm. Usually the problem doesn't start on the farm. The problem probably started with, you know, just the handling of the finished good itself. And it's very robust. And when I talk to folks in our quality assurance, they put a lot of faith in the regulations that the FDA has authorized through the pasteurized milk ordinance. So there's a lot of traceability. When we talk about social license, right, and we talk about net zero, and we talk about these sustainability initiatives, that gets really murky, right? If we're trying to trace the if someone wants to know the size of a farm because there's an ethic out there, someone thinks small farms are better, which I think is an unfair statement. Just trying to state whether or not, and I've gotten these questions before, what are the sizes of the farms that are producing the milk in Southern California, in my grocery store at Southern California? That's tricky because all of that milk ends up getting commingled, and we don't use our processes to find out a quality issue with those types of questions. So, you know, we can go into the supply chain, we can talk to our suppliers, we can ask them generalized questions, but the milk is getting commingled. If it's an ingredient, it's even more complex, as I alluded to before, and your macaroni and cheese packet has touched a lot of different processing points all the way to that spot. So that's complex. And Corey, is that touching on the question when we talk about traceability? Because from a health and quality perspective, the systems are very robust.
Well, I think that's good, Jordan. Anyone, Chris, Steve, or Mary, anything you want to add on that one?
Well, Corey, traceability, I think, also can be a broader term, not meaning specifically what Jordan is talking about, the real rigor that goes into making sure that we trace back along the supply chain. But when I was selling Ronnybrook milk at the Green Market in New York City back in the early 90s, consumers would come up to me and say, "What's so special about this milk?" And I said, "Well, for one thing, the farm's about 90 miles from here, and this milk in this glass bottle was probably milked about 36 hours ago." So the feeling of being connected to their food, and obviously New York City is probably the archetype of not being connected to your food, but it gave people that, it wasn't traceability technically, but it gave them a connection to their food, which I think people are really, really hungry for, and the dairy has a great story to tell.
That is so well said, Steve. And so our next dairy live stream will be on Wednesday, November 16th at 11 a.m. Central Time. It'll be archived on our Hordes Dairyman YouTube and podcast channels the very next day, just like this webcast will be tomorrow. We look forward to seeing you then. And on behalf of Steve James, Jordan Clark, Mary Kraft, and Chris Wolf, I am Corey Geiger, your host. I want to thank everyone for joining us today, and we wish you all a good day. Bye, everyone.